This is Aviator Cast, episode 66, From Sea to Shining Sea.
Calling all aviators, pilots, flight sim enthusiasts, and aviation lovers. You've landed at Aviator Cast. Join us weekly in our efforts to become better masters of the air through interviews, refreshers, lessons, training topics, simulator setup, hangar talk, news, and more. Buckle up and prepare yourself for this week's episode of Aviator Cast. Pre-flight complete, fuel on board, and flight plan filed. Let's kick the tires and light the fires. Here's your humble host, Chris Palmer.
Welcome, 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 aviators. You've landed at Aviator Cast. My name is Chris Palmer. From a young age, I looked to the powerhouse P-51s and beautiful B-17s with awe and admiration. Yes, these are incredible flying machines, but for me, it was more about the men that flew them. A generation, the greatest some say, that through war and honor paved the way for aviation today. It's Memorial Day, so a big thanks to all of you who serve in the military or have served, and a big throttle on to all those who have paid the ultimate sacrifice. We truly honor you and thank you for your service. So welcome to this, the 66th episode of Aviator Cast. It is fantastic to have you here on board. Aviator Cast is where we talk about aviation passion each and every week. If that is a lesson of some kind or a topic of some kind, or like today when we talk with an inspirational aviator. So today we're going to be talking to Leland Shanley. Leland is quite a diverse aviator. He was a naval aviator to start, and then he ended up getting in the airlines where he's been now for about 16 years, but he's delved into being an author of some historical fiction books, in addition to a production studio that he has that recently did a very cool thing on a documentary, apparently, with crashing a 727 that was basically a drone. So Leland is a really great guy. We're going to get into that interview here in a few minutes, but first, as always, we read a review from iTunes. Again, if you leave a review on iTunes for Aviator Cast and it is read on the show, then we will send you a free Aviator Cast limited edition t-shirt. So this one comes from Broadway Blues from the USA, and he says that he titles this, "For Those of Us That Live in the Clouds." He says, "I really like Chris with his passion for flying and also his humility when he talks about aviation. I came across the podcast when I saw a video of the now infamous takeoff that was really intriguing, and he was really intrigued by what happened. Instead of being hung-ho Top Gun, Chris broke down what happened, and he learned from older pilots. This debrief is the kind of information that I have not really gotten from books, and I am glad to have this type of information on hand. I've now listened to 3 podcasts, and I am totally hooked. Thanks for the great work, and I look forward to your next podcast." Thank you so much, Broadway Blues. Really appreciate it. I'm glad that you're finding some information here that you're having a hard time finding other places. Yes, we are all about humility here on Aviator Cast. We believe that is a core function of a great aviator, and so I try to share that humility with others, and I'm glad you see that, and I'm glad you're picking up on that, and I'm glad you're learning something. Again, Broadway Blues, if you hear this review, send me an email at me at aviatorcast.com, and I will send you an Aviator Cast t-shirt. Again, thank you so much for your review. I really appreciate it. All right, guys, so we're not going to delay too much longer. We're going to get right into this interview with Leland. Fantastic guest. He has a lot to share, and I think you guys will be a little jealous of his cool factor on being able to land on carriers, among other things. So here we go. Let's get into it with Leland Shanley.
Now, a special Hangar Talk segment.
All right, everybody. We are honored to have Leland Shanley with us today. How you doing, Leland?
Doing great. How are you, Chris?
Fantastic. Where are you coming to us from in the world?
St. Louis, Missouri.
St. Louis, Missouri, smack dab in the middle of the U.S. And Leland, what is it that you do for a living? Tell us about that.
Well, my day job, I'm a 777FO, Boeing 777 for American Airlines.
Okay.
Based out of Miami, actually, but I commute from St. Louis down. Gotcha. And then I write and also have a little production company.
Right on. Great. We're going to get to talk about all of those. You also have some military experience, correct?
Yes.
Great. And tell us just briefly about that. We're going to get into it in more depth later, but what's your military experience like?
I was a naval aviator, went through Navy ROTC here in University of Missouri.
Okay.
And then went to flight school in Pensacola, flew jets, and was EA-6B prowler pilot by trade, but I also was lucky enough to fly the F-4 Phantom and the A-4.
Great, great. Now, the first question I ask everyone that's on our show, and it's kind of a basic question, we're going to take you back many, many years, and that is, how did you initially fall in love with aviation? When did all of this stuff start for you?
Wow. You know, to be honest, it's all I ever wanted to do. I grew up in an aviation family. I had two uncles who were military pilots, and my grandfather had managed an airline. I think it was in the mid-20s, late-20s, when he got back from World War I, believe it or not. And that's just all I ever wanted to do. And so went to ROTC as soon as I graduated high school and signed up there. And University of Missouri was the only place or the only school in the area that had Navy. And my Uncle Larry had been killed as a naval aviator, and just kind of wanted to follow in his footsteps.
Gotcha. Do you mind telling us where he served and a little bit about him?
Sure. He was an Academy graduate, went to the Naval Academy. Larry Menzies was his name, and he flew the Navy back in those days called it the Able Dog, the AD-1, later became the A-1 Sky Raider when they re-lettered and numbered the airplanes. And he flew in Vietnam and then returned. He flew early in Vietnam. Returned and was in the reserves out of Glenview, Chicago in 1966 and was killed in an S-2F tracker on a training mission.
Wow. Well, I definitely want to touch on later about your feelings on, I guess, veterans and Memorial Day, because today, as we're recording this, it is Memorial Day. I think it's really cool that the stars kind of align that someone of your caliber that, you know, has been through the military, that has a pedigree in the military. It's great. It will be great to kind of get that perspective of aviation history and, I guess, even patriotism, you could say. So we'll definitely get into that later. Let's get into your flight training a little bit more. Tell us what it is like for a naval aviator to learn to fly. Tell us what that process is like.
Well, first thing you got to do is get a college degree, and it doesn't really much matter what it's in. I was an education major. I wasn't big on math, and it's a little tougher these days. I don't know if I could get in these days. They like engineers a lot more than in my day.
Mm-hmm.
You could get in with the old liberal arts degree like I had, and you go through, there's a few ways you can go through officer candidate school, aviation officer candidate school, where you go there after you graduate. My youngest son is actually doing a similar thing right now. He's putting together a package with the Marines. He wants to go fly for the Marines.
Gotcha.
And I did the ROTC route. So all through college, I was you know, doing the ROTC a couple days a week. And then once I graduated, I went to aviation indoctrination down in Pensacola. And then I was fortunate enough to be one of the last guys to fly the T-28, which was a great old airplane, radial engine and 1,400 horsepower. You know, for a Missouri kid who'd never flown before, it was an eye-opening experience, especially that first takeoff.
So that was the first aircraft you had ever flown in?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. I'd flown, I think, only twice in my life, maybe three times before that. Once in an airliner, once in a Cessna. No, I take it back. I went to the airborne school, so I went up five times, but didn't land those five times and jumped out.
Gotcha. Yeah, it doesn't count.
No, that doesn't count. So anyway, that was really my first experience. I think the first week I was flying for the Navy, I doubled the amount of flight time I had in my life.
Wow.
And so it was different. But I always told people it's a system designed for the average person with above average motivation.
Mm.
It was nothing that was really that hard.
Gotcha.
You just had to apply yourself, and it really had to become your life for the two and a half years it takes to get through it. And then I was fortunate enough, I got jet grades and actually went back to Pensacola to fly the T-2C. And in the T-2, you learn that's primary jet and straight wing, looks like a 50s vintage jet fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew that in formation, gun hops, and then you took it to the ship. And that's got my first traps on the Lexington, old wood deck.
Wow.
She was getting pretty tired even then.
Now that's a World War II carrier, isn't it?
Yeah, it fought in World War II, and quite a bit, extensively in World War II.
Right. I think it was wasn't it in the Battle of Midway or something like that?
No, the original Lex was sunk, I believe, in the Battle of Coral Sea.
Okay. Oh, wow. Pretty early.
And the next carrier, they renamed the Lexington.
Okay, gotcha.
To come out of the yard. So I don't think it was in Midway. But it was in just about the rest of the war. It really was all over the South Pacific. And
wow.
And hadn't changed much. The deck was still wooden. It was still, you know, they put an angle deck on it. But other than that, it hadn't really changed. It's down in Corpus Christi now as a museum.
Oh, wow. Cool.
But then after your carrier qual in the T-2, then you start all over again in the A-4.
Hmm.
And the A-4 is a light attack airplane, flew a lot in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew the two-seat version. And then you learn, you know, all this standard stuff, formation, night formation, low levels, and then also the weapons, weapons delivery, rockets, bombs, guns, and then also air combat, basic dogfighting. Then you go to the boat again. And if you qualify at the boat, then you go to get your wings. And then after you get your wings, then you get a fleet aircraft. And fleet boat or fleet plane, you go to the FRS, Fleet Replacement Squadron. And that takes usually 6 months. And for me, it was the EA-6B.
Mm.
And then you learn the aircraft and the weapon specialty. For the Prowler, it was electronic jamming and taking out SAM sites, kind of the wild weasel mission that the Air Force did.
Gotcha.
We used HARM missiles and then for hard kill, and SOF was jamming. And then when you're done, you go back to the boat and in the specific aircraft. And the big difference then is you take it to the boat at night, which that causes some washout rate. At each stage, there is a certain percent of washout rate. And then once you get to through the FRS, then you get sent to fleet squadron. And my first fleet squadron was VAQ 136 on the Midway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we were forward deployed in Japan.
Great.
So then you really get to start learning.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about landing on a carrier at night, because I think that's one of those things that is well known in the aviation community, is probably one of the most difficult things to do as a pilot or an aviator. Was it difficult for you? What was the experience like? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, it's very difficult. I'm sure you have some pilots in your audience, and try not to be too technical, but
yeah, we got a lot of them.
But basically, you go into manual holding on a radial and a distance from the ship, and you push down from the Marshall stack, we call it. It's like holding, even like airliners hold sometimes for weather.
Mm-hmm.
Except the whole air wing will be stacked up, and then you have to push at your point plus or minus 10 seconds. So, you know, and this was back in analog days, so you're trying to do all this on the clock and everything. And
wow.
So then you come down, you shoot a tack and penetration, and you arc at 12 miles till you get to the final bearing of the actual ship. And then you come up the ship's final bearing at 1,200 feet, put your gear flaps hooked down, and then you'll start flying the needles. We have raw data, ILS. They also had an ACLS, which was a more accurate system, but they had to lock up your airplane. And so a lot of times it didn't work very well. And then later, the ACLS system was tweaked for the Hornets, and it would actually lead your corrections. Well, for the rest of the fleet airplanes, we hated that, because we wanted to know where we were,
right,
not be led by a computer. So my last two cruises, I just use the ILS. The ILS is just a needle that moves left and right. It shows you're on course. And then another needle that moves up and down. Once you're on glide slope, you just want to keep them centered up on the attitude reference. And then at the same time, you have to fly constant, what we call angle of attack. You don't flare at all. The way you fly an approach at the ship is glide slope is control with all power. You really don't move the nose. You trim it up to an on-speed condition, optimum angle of attack. And then you maintain glide slope with just the throttles. And so you hold that cocked up attitude. And then when you get to 3/4 of a mile, you take over visually and fly the Fresnel lens. It's kind of like a unidirectional stoplight. Each cell you can only see if you're lined up with it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, and it's got green datum lines. So if you keep the yellow light in the center of the green datum lines, then you're on glide slope.
Wow.
If you're ball high, and it takes the shape of a ball. That's why you always hear, you know, the Navy guys calling the ball and all that.
Mm-hmm.
The light is round. So
gotcha.
Just to simplify it, they always call it the ball. And then you transition to lineup on the boat. You can see centerline lights. You see a carrier box, basically. And they got airplanes parked on both sides of the landing area. So you can't wander off lineup, or you'll drag a wingtip through the noses and radars of other aircraft, and they get excited about that.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And then if you got your optimal angle of attack and the glide slope and the lineup squared away, it should put you right on the three wire. And the three wire will pull you Well, any wires will pull you to a stop, you get your flaps up real quick, fold your wings because someone's right behind you, and then the worst part starts, and that's the taxiing around on the ship at night.
Wow.
And that can be scary, especially in the Prowler, because we sat well ahead of the nose gear, so we'd actually be out over the water sometimes when they were turning us at on the elevator or up on the bow. So it was interesting.
That's a little weird. I guess I never thought of that. I would think that they kind of just connected a tug or something to it and got it out of the way quick, but it makes sense that you just, I guess, power out where you need to go.
Yeah. You have to get out of there quickly, and they're moving so many airplanes. Is generally the way a launch works is, or any a cycle we'd call it, was you'd launch the aircraft first, and then as they're finishing up the launch, if you were one of the first guys down, you could see airplanes in a landing area as you were approaching, as they were still shooting off the waste catapults or moving them up to Cat 1 or 2.
Jeez.
And so, I mean, it's very time critical. It's very it's kind of like a ballet, really.
Yeah.
Everything's choreographed, everything's moving in one motion, and airplanes are being refueled, rearmed if you're in a combat zone, and a lot going on. A lot of young men and women up on the flight deck, most of them around 18, 19 years old, and they work hard. They work 20-hour days up there, and it's pretty dangerous as well.
Yeah, definitely. Everyone has to be diligent and, like you said, choreographed. I can imagine it just has to be so organized.
Yeah, it really does.
So tell us about, continue on with your Navy career from there, or your military career in general, and where you went from there, and maybe into some of the action that you saw, stuff like that. Why don't we go that direction now?
Okay. After the Midway, I came back to Texas to be an instructor in the A4. And I was an A4 instructor. I was also an LSO, landing signal officer. That's a pilot stands out on the deck and helps guide other pilots in, especially at night. It's critical.
So he's the guy that would be talking to you on the radio, basically?
Yeah. In close, and giving power calls or waving off or just sweet talking guys on on a rough night. Sometimes the deck will move so much that you can't really use the lens, and so the LSOs get them aboard. We have a backup system that we actually control. It kind of looks like the ball looks the same, except we're moving the actual visual presentation. And it's called the Movilus, and that's for when the deck is really moving. The Midway moved a lot. The deck was really unstable and pitched quite a bit.
Gotcha.
But and rolled. But anyway, so I went back teaching the youngsters how to fly the A4 and land on the ship, and did that for 3 years, and then I went back to the fleet as a department head with VAQ 137. And we went VAQ 137. We deployed to Bosnia when that action was going on. We were flying over Bosnia every day to try to keep the, I guess it was the Serb Air Force from flying their MiGs.
Wow. So more of a presence of power sort of thing?
Yeah, it was we were trying to just keep them out of the air.
Gotcha.
And so they wouldn't use the bombers. It was when Yugoslavia broke up, it was pretty much a three-way civil war over there between Serbs and Bosnians, and then the Dalmatian coast. I forget what group that was, but Anyway, so we did that for months, and then the Blackhawks were shot down in Somalia.
Oh, wow.
So we went through the Suez Canal and then down off of Somalia for, we were down there a couple of months as well. And that was interesting. And then on the way back through there, we flew over Iraq, a couple of missions over Iraq while we were in the Red Sea, went back to the Suez Canal, flew a couple of missions up from Southern Mediterranean, long 7-hour mission up to film mass graves. I was covering the tarps bird. Tarp is a pod that hangs on a tomcat back in the day, and it was a photo pod. It could take high resolution photographs of the ground.
Gotcha.
And we went up, filmed a mass grave up in Bosnia again, and then came back and came home, and then stood down that squadron. There were a lot of cutbacks after the first Gulf War, so we stood down that squadron, and I went to another squadron and then went right back to sea. And on that cruise, we spent 5 months flying over Iraq during the deny flight stuff over Iraq.
Gotcha.
And then after that, I went down to Naval Weapons Test Squadron, Point Lugu, California, just north of L.A., and I flew the F-4 there as a test pilot, and we got to do all kinds of crazy stuff with F-4s, and even got to test ejection seats. Didn't ride it, but wow. I popped it out of my airplane. That was pretty neat. And did a bunch of other stuff, and then after that tour, I retired and gotcha. Went to the airlines.
Gotcha. Cool. When did you start writing, by the way?
Oh, I was when I first got out, I was a military, an aviation technical advisor on 5 movies. Mm-hmm. And part of it was I would rewrite parts of the script sometimes, and that got me started. And then my first book, was called Project 7 Alpha. I saw a plaque in the training center at American Airlines. And so I was just kind of intrigued by it and looked it up. And what it was is early in the war, they were really having trouble with standing the Air Force up, getting enough people to fly missions over the Himalayas, over the hump, out of India into China and Burma.
Mm-hmm.
And so FDR asked C.R. Smith, president of American Airlines at the time, to basically stand up a squadron and send it to the Assam Valley in India to fly combat missions into China.
Wow.
And Burma. And so they put together a group of mechanics and operations guys and air crew, and they went over and flew cargo in and wounded soldiers and whatever else needed to come out. And it was really interesting, historical little tiny window of, you know, all the sacrifices that was going on.
Right. How did you get into that material and dig into the history of it and find out more?
Well, you know, I got real lucky. I was surfing around on the internet. And you're too young, I can tell by your picture. But back in the old days, they used to have, they didn't really have Xerox machines. They had these crank type copiers.
Mm-hmm.
And they had purple ink. And I found one that the guy who had run the operation, Project 7 Alpha, he had published a summary that they sent to the airline in 1946, and someone scanned that original copy into the internet, and I was able to get a copy of it, and that's pretty much was the blueprint of the book.
Wow, so it was like a written history, essentially?
Yes.
of what they had done. So like kind of day-to-day operations of the quote unquote airline in China, if you will.
Yeah. And it got down into some details, like they had a group, and I even put it in the book, a group of guys that were really kind of whiners. And so they fired them in India and sent them home.
Wow.
And it had some really good details in it and some insight into some of the personalities. And you know, they lost one full crew and then another captain who they were flying back into the Assam Valley, and the weather could change without notice, especially it could fog over. And yeah, the Assam Valley fogged over, and they didn't have the fuel to go anywhere else. So he held the aircraft while his crew bailed out, but he wasn't able to get out. So that was the other loss.
Wow. There's a story. Okay, so let's circle back a little bit, because I don't think we made this clear enough to the listeners. So Leland, you're an author as well. You've written, from what I could see, 4 to 5 books. How many books have you actually written?
I've got a chapter in a test pilot book that's a nonfiction. I also wrote a nonfiction a while back, but that's not available anymore. And then I have, I'm writing my 5th novel right now. The 4th one is scheduled to be published on the 21st of July. And these are all the Aviator series. Each one's a standalone novel, but it's the same characters. The first one is early World War II. The second one, Vengeance at Midway and Guadalcanal, picks up at the beginning of the war, follows a young naval aviator through training and through the Guadalcanal campaign. And then the third one, Endgame in the Pacific, that wraps up the Pacific War. Gotcha. I also have characters in Europe as well, so you get both sides of the World War II. Gotcha. And then the fourth one is right at the end of the war, and it's got a little bit of a twist and more of an alternate history type twist to it. One of the main characters, SS general, escapes Germany as it dissolves with nuclear weapons, and then the chase is on after that.
Wow, that sounds very interesting. And I apologize for not having time to read one of your books. I'm definitely going to go pick one of them up. Probably the Midway one. I've always been fascinated with the Battle of Midway. So essentially, you're doing historical fiction, right?
Absolutely. I take the timeline, like in the Battle of Midway, I just took the ship's log from various ships in the battle group and used that timeline, and then insert my characters. And, you know, I know a lot about old airplanes, and, you know, I've flown obviously from some of the ships that were from that era.
Right.
So I hope I landed some genuineness, but it's a lot of fun. I enjoy doing it.
That's really great. So kind of while we're on the subject, I think we'll probably hit this now. Because it's Memorial Day, I thought it would be an interesting opportunity for you to share what your experience like and what your connection is to, I guess, that sacrifice, if you will, that our military has made for this country, and specifically kind of an aviation look on that. Because I think a lot of the time, you know, we as a nation, we think of the guys that are on the front lines and boots on the ground, and from our perspective, obviously being interested in aviation, we always wonder what it was like for aviators, you know, in the different wars. So kind of an open-ended, I guess, just opening of a discussion there. to get your thoughts on Memorial Day and the things you think of on this day, I suppose. Maybe people in your life that you know that have passed on or that have impacted you. So I'll just open that up and kind of see where it goes and maybe prod you a little bit.
Sure. Well, you know, obviously for me, I was 7 or 8 years old when my uncle was killed in a accident. And then my uncle Bob Milham, he was actually shot down a couple times in Vietnam, but was always able to, he flew AC-119 gunships, but was always able to get to an alternate field. And so he made it back unscathed. But it is personal. I think for aviation, it's different. It's more of a continuous, like, slow burn, if you will, because for example, the first week of the Gulf War, I think we lost more aircraft in the training command or stateside than we did in, at least for the Navy.
Right.
Because of training accidents. And
then you did in the actual war, right?
Yes.
Right. And,
you know, it's just a dangerous business, especially landing on the ships. And and there's a, you know, for your average person, they see it on the news, boom, boom, flash, it's gone. But when you live it, I mean, that hole is there forever. You know, that person you lost, or whether it's a relative or not. On my first cruise, we lost EA-6B rounding the tip of India. Never knew what happened. They took off and just never came back.
Wow.
Commanding officer was in it. It was going to be the night of his 1,000 carrier landing, which is a big deal in Navy. And they just never came back. And that's something in naval aviation that happens quite often. It's a big ocean, and if they don't find any of the parts quickly, they sink. And, you know, what I think about is the families, because I saw it affects the families, and it never goes away.
Right. Definitely something for all of us to remember. I think back to the very early days too. You know, I look all the way back to World War II, especially being of my generation where we don't have too much time left to appreciate that in person, where those guys that were part of that era are now passing on. I mean, very few of them are left, really. We're just at the tail end of the rest of them being around. And so we're really at the, kind of that the end of being able to honor those people. And so, what we do about that, I don't know. But I guess...
My airline has actually been doing what we call honor flights, where we try to take the World War II vets to Washington, D.C. to see the memorial.
Oh, that's great.
The war memorial. And that's been going on for a few years now. And but, yeah, I mean, it was – people have no idea how many – well, just naval aviation, for example. When I got my wings, this would have been in the 80s, my instructor told me since, you know, the beginning of naval aviation – 80,000 guys were winged with naval aviator wings. And he said, and 60,000 of them were winged in a 4-year period during World War II. So,
wow.
That gives you, you know, some idea of how many people were out there, what percent of the population. And it's so much smaller now.
Right, definitely. It's a rare breed these days, but one that is still very much appreciated. So, you know, on behalf of the listeners, I thank you for your your contribution to that, and also all those out there listening that have contributed to our military, not just, you know, naval aviation, but anyone that has fought to protect our freedoms. I think we'll all here give a shout out to them and a big appreciation for that. So let's move on from that. Let's talk about your airline career. Let's talk about transitioning from, you know, being a military pilot into the airlines. It sounds like that was kind of a direct thing that you did. Tell us more about that transition. You know, if it was difficult going from a fighter jet to an airliner, tell us about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, I retired. We moved back. My wife and I had grown up here in St. Louis, a little suburb called Webster Grove. So we moved back with our four kids. And I was working for an air cargo company called Kitty Hawk, flying 727s.
Mm-hmm.
And I got on with them, went through training. A couple months later, got furloughed. So I was laid off, substitute taught while I scrambled to get applications out with other airlines. And while I was furloughed, I got hired by American Airlines. Then I started at American, June of 99. And I got hired into the MD-80, and I mostly stayed on the MD-80. Oh, gosh, for 15 years, I guess. And, great old airplane, 50s, 60s technology. And then I transitioned from that to the 777, which, that was a transition.
Yeah. Gosh.
I kept hearing the old joke in my mind. What was it? An old captain sitting in front of a new glass cockpit turns to the instructor and said, "Now I know what a dog feels like staring at the TV." And that's kind of what it feels. It's very different. And the flying is very different. I mean, you go from short hops, wanting to fly as much as you can, to three legs, four legs a day, and you've had enough by mm-hmm. mid-month.
Right. But,
so it's very different. And the hard part is to try to keep it from becoming a job.
Right, right.
And with all the turmoil, things were great when I started the airline, and then 9/11 hit and a tech bubble crash, and it devastated the airlines pretty good. And so, all the bankruptcies and everything else, that was pretty tough. But
right.
The actual flying is, quite a bit different. But, an ILS is an ILS. That's, the instrument landing system. And GPS was new. That was coming in, which is nice. You get spoiled with GPS real quick.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, when I was flying the A4, we had basically a compass and a TACAN, and that was about it. And then now the F4, we did have a GPS called the Poor Man's HUD. It was a first generation Garmin that we just bolted to the glare shield.
Oh my gosh.
But since we were a test squadron, we could self-approve, so we didn't have to go through all the red tape to get that done. And that worked pretty good. But, and then having big crews and a bunch of people behind you.
Right. Yeah. What typical routes do you fly?
Flying's flying.
Yep. Where do you typically fly? You said you're based in Miami.
I am. I fly the 777 out of Miami. We generally go to London, Madrid, Buenos Aires, Sao Paulo, Rio, and Santiago.
Wow.
So usually 8-9 hour flights and 3-man crews.
Gotcha. So you'll have one relief pilot?
Yes. Yeah. And we have a bunk room, so you get a couple hours of sleep each flight, and that helps a lot.
Now, are you flying, American only has the 300, is that right?
No, we have 200s.
Okay.
And 300s.
What are you typically flying on those routes?
Usually the 200.
Okay.
Sao Paulo's is 300. But, gotcha. The 300s, I think, have been, they go to London and Sao Paulo out of Miami. And then out of Dallas, I think they go to Hong Kong. And we're just starting to get 300s. We're getting a couple more this year, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I remember that kind of being the flagship rollout for when you guys changed your paint scheme. You know, they had the brand new 777-300 in the new paint scheme, and that was a big deal.
Yeah, it's a great airplane. It really flies nice. The flight characteristics of it are pretty amazing for the size of the airplane. It's the easiest airplane I've ever landed, I think.
Well, you've had some difficult landings, so I think that anything from there is a little easier.
Oh, it's a nice airplane. I really like it.
So tell us a little bit more. Some of the conversations we've had on the show, we talk a lot about automation dependency. What are your feelings on that, and what's kind of the policy of American in allowing the pilots to actually hand fly the aircraft?
Well, we have always hand flown at American, and most of the guys I fly with anyway generally will fly it. Oh, now with the new reduced spacing, you have to have the autopilot on, and I think at 28. So most guys will fly it, hand fly it up into the 20s, and then turn the autopilot on for the cruise portion. And then it's very rare you do an auto land or a Cat 3 landing, Cat 3 or Cat 2 landing.
Mm-hmm.
Guys land them by hand.
Right.
And our training is, we've always done unusual attitudes. And one thing that they've added a few years back is they've been having all these multiple failures of the automation and instrumentation and stuff. So we actually will fly an approach in training every 9 months where virtually nothing works. No airspeed, no altimeter, VSI,
wow,
none of the magic. And you got to bring it back and do a raw data ILS to a landing. And just power and attitude. Power and attitude equals performance.
Yep. Just like the old days, putting it down on the carrier deck. Just get that angle of attack and bring it down with power, right?
Exactly.
Cool. So we have a lot of our listeners are a mix of several different things. First, they are younger pilots or maybe even middle-aged guys that are looking to get their pilot's license, looking to get into aviation. We also have people that are kind of going back to something you said, looking to keep their passion alive. So making sure that their aviation jobs don't just become a job, that they kind of keep that passion alive. What would you say for, let's start first with the new pilots, and then let's get to the keeping the passion alive subject, if you don't mind.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, the new pilots, man, they're going to inherit the earth. I happen to know exactly what the average age of American Airlines is. It's starting to change now, but for a long time, the average age of both seats at American Airlines was my age.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be 57 in September. So virtually 90% of my airline is going to retire and, you know, in a very short period of time. So the advancement and the opportunity that's out there for the young guys is going to be fantastic. Obviously, you want to be on the first half of the power curve on that. First half of the guys in will be captains. Second half won't. That's the way it works. And But yeah, the opportunity, and it's not just my airline, it's just about every airline out there. We're very old as a group, the airline pilots, which is, I think, why they raised the age to 65, just to kick the can down the road a few years.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And they may try to 67, but I can tell you, I'm not going to fly that long. Not day to day, not for the airlines. It wears on you after a while. But for the young guys, yeah, the opportunity is just incredible. And it's started, but it's really going to pick up here in the next 2 to 3 years.
What would be any advice for them to kind of jump on the bandwagon? What would you say?
Well, you know, it's the same advice. It's been out there forever. It's, you know, you got to get your flight time, and you gotta get out there and hit the street and ask people to help you. That's one of the things I've always loved about this profession, is that the old guys are really more than willing to help the young guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a theme I try to put across in my books as well, is, you know, they feel that they have to give back to the next generation. And so I help guys all the time, whether it's a job recommendation or whatever. They need to get out and meet some guys. If they're on a jump seat, talk to the captain.
Right.
You know, and you'd be surprised. Most guys will offer up the help without even being asked. And so that, and then, you know, obviously jet time, turboprop time, that's multi-engine. That's what you need. But when you go, it's all about the interview. And because everybody's there because they're qualified.
Right, exactly.
And it's all about the interview. And now with the internet, it's so much easier. We used to have this box when I was in the Navy. Guys who were getting out, they called it the Ark of the Covenant. And it was, because back then there were so many airlines, and each airline kind of did their own thing as far mm-hmm. as the interview process. And it had everything in there, you know, what to wear, what not to wear, you know, the blue suit, white shirt, power tie, all that stuff. And, you know, what you don't want to do is be the guy who sticks out. So that is, when you do get the interview, you really have to spend some time. And there are, there's quite a few services out there that will prep you
right.
for your specific airline interview. And, you know, it's worth it. I think it's worth it.
Yeah, that seems like a smart idea if you're really gunning for it. All right, so what about the guys that are maybe becoming a bit disenfranchised or losing the passion for it? What do you do to keep your passion alive?
Well, and trust me, I know exactly what you're talking about. You start flying 80 hours a month, and in this job, you have to understand it comes with a lot of family separation, mm-hmm. whether you're on a ship for 6 months or you're gone half of every month.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be gone. You're going to miss holidays. You're going to miss birthdays and all those family sort of things. And also, so it really does get hard to keep the motivation. For me, you know, I write my books, do things in movie and TV industry. We did a documentary a while back for Discovery called Plane Crash. And we droned a 727, filled it with its experiments for survivability, and then crashed it in the Sonoran Desert. It was droned.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, it was. And I was controlling it. It was my company that put it together. And we had a great time doing that. I brought in my friends and a couple of my kids and, you know, put together a great show and had a lot of fun. And then tomorrow morning, I'm actually leaving to go get a CJ6 Alpha Nanching, little Chinese trainer. with a round engine in it, and I just want to put some vitamin G back on my body again. I have some fun flying.
Some vitamin G, I like it. Is that an aircraft that you've bought that you're ferrying back to St. Louis?
It sure is. Yeah, right. It's out in Phoenix. I'm going to go out and pick it up, get trained in it tomorrow, and probably start back on Wednesday.
Great. Do you own any other airplanes?
I have a quarter share of a Musketeer. Both of them are 1966 models, as a matter of fact.
Cool.
And keep it out here at Spirit of St. Louis Airport.
Great. Well, it sounds like you're doing many different diverse things, I guess, keeping your passion alive. And I think that's what it takes. I think at the end of the day, it comes down to diversity, getting out there and trying different things and getting kind of out of the mundane routine, because a lot of these younger aviators that are so excited about their aviation career, I know it was this way for me, and although I didn't end up going to the airlines, I know just with my body of friends and acquaintances that at some point it does become a job, you know, and if you can make sure that you are reminding yourself in some sort of way that, you know, this actually kind of isn't just a job, that this is pretty cool, then it takes the edge off of it, I guess, and makes it a little better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to meet with us today. You and I kind of rode over the weekend, and you said that you're going to go pick up that aircraft in Phoenix, so I thought it would be a fantastic opportunity to meet now. Any final words for our listeners? Any places you want to direct them, like your website, things like that?
Oh, yeah. LelandShanley.com. You can find my books there. It's LelandShanley.com. You can get any of my books there. You can pre-order the fourth one. And yep, just keep them flying and have fun. Remember to have fun. You're not having fun, you're not doing it right.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate the time, Leland. We will we'll make sure we plug your stuff, and great job. I'll be reading one of your books soon.
All right, thanks, Chris.
I appreciate it. Take care, Leland. See ya.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Join us next week for another exciting topic or interview with a great guest. Spread the Aviator Cast message. Please review Aviator Cast on iTunes or submit an audio question for the show at aviatorcast.com. All iTunes reviews and audio questions that are aired on the show will get an official Aviator Cast t-shirt. You can write Aviator Cast directly on aviatorcast.com, where you can interact with the Aviator Cast community, or write Aviator Cast at me@aviatorcast.com. We'd love to hear from you. For more information on angle of attack simulation training videos for FSX, X-Plane, and more, go to www.flyaoamedia.com. If you are looking for professional aviation training video services and other media, inquire at www.angleofattackpro.com. Now, for the final release clearance, back to Chris Palmer.
A big, big thanks to Leland for joining us on this episode of AviatorCast. Leland, we really appreciate your insight and your experience and sharing a little bit of your precious time with us. We know that it was a holiday, so we really appreciate you spending a few, or at least an hour, speaking to us on AviatorCast. If you guys want to check out what Leland does, you can do that by going to LelandShanley.com, as he mentioned, and you can find his books there and get some more information about all the other stuff that he does. So a big thanks also goes out to the Angle of Attack crew for all they do to make this episode of AviatorCast possible and all the other episodes. These guys do a great job behind the scenes, keeping the business running and doing a lot of great work at Angle of Attack. Thank you to you listeners for being here. It truly is an honor to get to come up with some material for you guys each and every week. I know that you guys are out there fighting your battles, trying to stay in the cockpit, and just really enjoying aviation, and I hope that you get something out of this each and every week. Thanks for coming back. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for reviewing AviatorCast in different areas, especially on iTunes. You can join us next week. We'd love that. We'd love to have you back. So we will see you then. Until next time, throttle on.
10-5-8 is ready. 10-5-8 is the short line. Turn left heading 235. Maintain 2000. Runway 25 right. Clear for takeoff.
Clear for takeoff. 25 right. United 580.